I'm supposed to introduce Jim at this point, right? I met Jim, I guess the first time I met him was about 4 weeks ago at the College Park, 4 or 5 weeks ago at the College Park group. I don't even know if you remember, I was there with Rob. And then after that, I think the first interaction that I had with Jim was when I was being coy, or I guess you would say lying about my bowling skills a few weeks ago. we went out, and it was really neat because we all went out and we had a good time, and there was a mixed age group, all, you know. And we actually had a really good time together. And I've had numerous conversations with himself and other people that I met that night. And I really enjoy that group of people. And I'm very excited, very anxious to hear your story. I'm sure it's going to be colorful and good. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, John.
All right, Jim.
I have to stand up. I can't sit down. I'm sorry. I want to thank John. Oh, thank you. I want to thank John for inviting me out here. I want you all to know how much I appreciate you being here. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Jim Powers. My sobriety date is February 18, 2002. Central is my home group. And I get asked to speak every now and then, and usually when I'm going through a world of trouble or a world of self-imposed self-centeredness. And so this is one of those times where when John asked me, one of the things that my sponsors have taught me is that I don't say no to AA no matter what. And tonight's one of those nights, and I'm really glad to be here. I did take my watch off. That watch has been on my arm for the past 4 years, and it's been on my arm because I took it off my little brother's arm, who's 10 years younger than me, when he died in Florida hospital from untreated alcoholism. And I put it on my arm and I wear it everywhere I go to remember my little brother, who didn't want to come into this program, didn't want a spiritual way of life, and took it to the bitter end, like it says in our book. And I always try to talk about him right off the bat, because if not, you're going to see a grown man cry. And you're probably going to see him cry anyway, because that's just the way I am. I am a redneck. I am not a racist. I sponsor a lot of guys. I sponsor a lot of people that have different sexual persuasions, all men. And I've never been really prejudiced, except in my early days when that's the way I was brought up. I learned when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it doesn't matter what your problems, doesn't matter who you are. All that matters is if you reach out your hand for help, I have a responsibility to carry the message of AA, and that's what I do. To tell you a little bit about myself, I was born into a family that was not an alcoholic family. My father was an Air Force hero, commander of bases all over the world. My mother was not an alcoholic. I had three older sisters who weren't alcoholic, an older brother not an alcoholic, and my younger brother who died from this disease. So I wasn't around alcohol or alcoholism. I was around a military family, which was kind of strict. But that's just the way, you know, military families were. We moved all over the world about every couple of years. I was just getting to know people where I was, and then we were picking up and we were moving somewhere else. And I have all kinds of, I had all kinds of excuses when I first started doing the steps on why I was an alcoholic. And my sponsor allowed me to go through all those different excuses until about 100, 101, and then he just said, that's enough, you're an alcoholic because you drink for the effect produced by alcohol, and it's right in the doctor's opinion. And that's exactly right. I didn't have any reasons. I drank because I wanted to be drunk, and I drank from an early age. We moved from Japan to Washington State in 1964, and because I was already on the road to alcoholism, I was 10 years old, my little brother was born, and some kids and I were coming home from school one day, and we were going through the woods, and we caught a little mouse, and one of my friends got bit by the little mouse, and I don't know why we kept it in a lunchbox, but we took it home, and his mom asked him what happened, and of course on a base, the news travels fast, and the next thing I know, my mom is asking me, did I get bit? And the thing that went through my head is, I don't have to go to school tomorrow if I got bit by this mouse. So I said yes, and I didn't have any bites on me at all. Well, I had to go to school the next day, but I had to go get a rabies shot first. And in 1964, let me tell you what happened, is they have to cut the head off the mouse in Washington State, send it to Washington, D.C. to find out if it has rabies. And so for the next 11 days, every day before I went to school, I got another rabies shot. And those are pretty painful. And that was all the start of my career in lying. You know, I wanted not to go to school, I lied, and I got some really nice consequences from it. The next year we were in Duluth, Minnesota. If you all ever chance to go to Duluth, Minnesota, don't. It was really cold there. It was a miserable place there. And all I remember is that's when I had my first drink. I was 11 years old. My oldest sister got married. We were at the reception. And the colonel, my father, said that everybody in the family could have one little sip of champagne and toast my sister. Some of y'all might know about a guy named Bill Oakley. He used to be speaking around here a lot. He was from the Kissimmee area. And he talked about that golden moment. And I always said, I don't know about that golden moment. All I knew is when I took that drink, because I didn't sip mine, my sisters and brothers did, I just chugged mine right back down. Something happened inside of an 11-year-old boy. And something so powerful happened to me that all I wanted was more. And my disease of alcoholism, my illness of alcoholism, was one of more for many years. I went back by that champagne fountain. I got five more of those. You know, normally you don't notice a little 11-year-old boy at a reception until he starts spinning around and falling down. And I guess my parents knew I was drunk. They put me in the bedroom, and then the bed started spinning, and my head was spinning. My stomach was spinning. I don't know if anybody's done it before, but then I threw up. And I peed on myself. And so the next morning when I came to, and I had a headache that I could only describe as a little man in my head with an anvil and a sledgehammer just banging away. I was 11 years old and I couldn't wait to do it again. And that's my career started right then. 2 years later we moved down to Orlando. I was 13 years old and I wanted to be drunk every opportunity I could. And 11 or 13 year old boy did not have a lot of opportunities to go earn money. And so this room right here reminds me of a lot of rooms that I spent a lot of time in. I was a burglar. I became a burglar at 13, and I started stealing from cars to begin with. I started breaking into homes. And all I was trying to do, I wasn't trying to get your jewelry or your silverware or anything else at first. All I wanted to do was find your booze. And as long as I had your booze, I had my relief. I had my feeling. I didn't like school, like I told you, and so I didn't go to school very often. So I went to the juvenile detention facility up on Michigan Avenue. And they had a little square room like this, much smaller. And you sat there all day, and they tried to teach you that this was wrong. And I never got the lesson. Every time I got out of there, I got right back with my friends. We went right back to burglarizing people. And over, it repeated itself. Until I turned 16 and started carrying a gun. And then I became an armed robber. I'm not proud of a lot of the stuff that happened. I'm just telling you what happened. Because what I learned in here is that I've been able to help a lot of gentlemen that did the same thing that I did. People coming out of jails. I take meetings into jails and detoxes today because that's where I see myself. And I remind myself of where I was way before I ever got into Alcoholics Anonymous. I spent many days and many hours behind bars. I got out of jail when I was 17 years old. I got bonded out. I was charged with a whole truckload of felonies in Central Florida, including armed robbery. And my dad bailed me out one last time because I begged him. I did the alcoholic beg. You know, Dad, I'll never do this again. I promise I'll never do this again. Just get me out. And he didn't. And that night I broke into his gun cabinet. I took the .45 automatic he carried through three wars. I went over the back wall and I took off between here and California. And this is Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am very much a traditionalist in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the history. I study the history. And I study the traditions. This is in the 60s, and so there was a lot of drugs involved in my story. But alcohol was there when I started, and alcohol was there when I stopped. But in case, you know, somebody doesn't like it, occasionally there's drugs that slip out in my story because they're just part of my story. Between here and California, I was on an armed robbery spree, and I wound up with serum hepatitis when I got to California. I was 17 years old, and I was shooting up with dirty needles, shooting up heroin and things like that. Heroin was a very short-lived in my life because the gentleman was shooting the same amount of heroin sitting next to me, and he died. He shot his, I shot mine, he died right there sitting next to me. I never wanted to do heroin again. I quit. Alcohol was not that way with me. In California, they put me in a military hospital. It was 6 weeks, 8 weeks, I can't remember, for me to get well enough for me to get out. I was orange. I had yellow jaundice. And they told me, you know, if I didn't stop doing this stuff, I was probably going to die then. And I'm 17 years old. I left California, went up to Minnesota. All the way up to Minnesota, I was paying for my way through alcohol and robberies. Came back to Orlando. Knew I was wanted for interstate flight with all these felonies, and went to a party, and the police knew the party was there. Actually, they knew I was there at a party because they had been looking for me. They raided the party. I had just done some other pharmaceuticals that were animal tranquilizers. They call it PCP, but I had done that and been drunk and had a .38 in my hand as the police came in through the front door. And they were at the bottom of the staircase pointing their guns at me, and I was up at the top of the staircase pointing my gun at them. And I can't really tell you how long it lasted. It couldn't have lasted long. But we were both yelling at each other, drop your gun, drop your gun. And, you know, a man retired as the chief of Maitland Police Department. His name was Ed Doyle. He should have killed me. And he did. And I did drop my gun. And I had hepatitis again. And they took me back to the Orange County Jail. And this time I wasn't getting out. I was in isolation because it was the second round of hepatitis C, and I went before a judge. I was 18 years old, and the judge looked at my record, looked at my juvenile record, looked at my criminal charges, and said, you really don't have much of a chance. I'm going to sentence you to 52 years in the state penitentiary in Rayford, Florida, and I'm 18 years old. Now, people talk about fear in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I always relate that back to that moment in my life when fear was the most overwhelming thing, because I knew about Rayford, and I knew I wasn't coming back. There's no way. Not an 18-year-old punk. So I wound up going back to my isolation cell, and after I got sober, I remembered this, and I remembered that that was the first time I knew that God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, because the only book in that isolation cell was a Bible. I did not go to church. I'm not opposed to church. I'm just not a regular churchgoer. AA is my church. AA is where I found spirituality. I don't diss churches. Organized religion is good for those who want to go there, and I'm all for it. But all I know is that day in that cell, and for the next 14 days, all I was doing was holding that Bible and begging God, please don't let this happen. Please don't let this happen. And 2 weeks later, I was called before that judge, and I don't know the reason to this day, but that judge had a change of heart, and he said, instead of going up to Rayford, I'm going to send you 18 months to a chain gang. And so Orange County in 1972 did have a chain gang. They did not have chains on you, but if you've seen the movie Cool Hand Luke, it was the exact same thing, only without chains, because if you ran from that chain gang and the guards didn't shoot you, you did 5 years in a state penitentiary just for the escape charge. And so 18 months versus 52 years, I thought, okay, I can do this. And I did it. What I did, though, was not what normal people do. I was out on the road 6 days a week. You see these people out now, the work release or the work people. I always wave at them because they just, you know, they're out there with weed eaters and blowers and, you know, things like that. And in 1972, you had a swing blade and you were in the ditch and you were not moving unless you were moving up, boss, moving up, boss. And like I said, it was just like that movie. But I saw something that a lot of people didn't see. You're feeding 150 people three meals a day in a chain gang. That's how many people were out where 33rd Street is now. And I said, I need to get in that kitchen. You know, I need to get off of this chain gang in the weeds. I need to get into that building where it's air conditioned. I need to get into that pantry where there's ingredients that if you put them together and you put them on a shelf and you let them ferment for a while, you can make what's called buck. And it's alcohol that they make in prisons. And it's pretty potent, it's pretty good if you're an alcoholic. If you're not an alcoholic, you would never drink that stuff in all your life. But as an alcoholic, I can tell you one of the ingredients, because I at one time I actually spoke and told all the ingredients, and I felt like a fool afterwards. I was teaching people how to go out and make moonshine, and that was wrong. But one of the ingredients that was a filler in there was a rotten grapefruit that sit on the ground for like 3-4 weeks or a month after they fall off the trees. We use that for the filler. So we put that in there, and that helped ferment the other ingredients. And after a couple of weeks, we drained it through a sock. My joke is, I don't know if it was a clean or a dirty sock. And it didn't matter. It didn't matter, because once you drained it through that sock, you held your nose and drank it, you got the effect produced by alcohol. And I'm in a chain gang trying to be rehabilitated, and all I'm trying to do is get alcohol in my system every day. Every day. I got out of the chain gang. I learned my lesson. I did my parole afterwards. I only went to jail one more time. I did learn my lesson. I didn't get caught, but I didn't stop doing a lot of the things. But once I went to jail that last time, I said, that's enough. I don't want to do this anymore. And almost 99% of all those outside influences in my life went away. But alcohol is legal. And 1978, I met a little girl in Mississippi. We got drunk, we took some pills, we went to bed, we fell in love, we got married. And that's not normal. People don't get married that way. Normal people go out on a date. Normal people, you go to the movies, you have dinner. I got in love, I say, and it was lust, I can tell you that now, as an alcoholic. And she lived with me and stayed with me for 21 years. And I drank every day until I blacked out. Now, God bless her for putting up with me that long. I did not drink in the daytime, in the morning, except when it was after 1 o'clock in the morning I was still drinking. But I didn't get up in the morning and drink. I had a job in real estate that my dad helped me get. Once I got back into Florida, he and I made our reconciliation. And I started doing pretty well in real estate. And one of the things my dad told me is, you don't drink with your clients and don't drink during the day. No problem. Now, both my grandfathers were raging alcoholics and died of alcoholism, but my family didn't talk about it. They were never talked about it. And so I never knew anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. In 1998, and I'm going to fast forward real quick here, because all it was is I made a lot of money. I got up every day and went to work, and when I got off of work, on the way home, I was drinking Schlitz malt liquor, because that was my beer of choice. I was drinking the cheapest whiskey you could buy at an ABC, and I always had a gallon at the house. I never hid bottles because I knew where my bottles were. I never ran out. And so being a successful business person and drinking and passing out, big deal. You know, I'm making the money in the family. We've got two cars. We have a house on a lake. I'm pretty successful. I'm pretty well known in the community. So I'm not an alcoholic. In my mind, I'm not an alcoholic. I started having some back trouble from some things I'd done early in life. My middle sister was dying from multiple myeloma, which is a bone marrow disease. And it was just really weird how she got that. We think from nuclear radiation when we were in New Mexico. Maybe I should blame that on my alcoholism. I don't know, but no. But she had some, and this will be the last time, she had Percodan. And she knew my back was really hurting me, and so I started taking some Percodan and drinking heavy alcohol at night. And something started happening in my body. You know, something started going wrong. And one night about 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, my bladder said to get up, and my brain didn't hear it. And this woman who was married to me was standing on the bed screaming at me that I'm peeing all over. And I wasn't peeing all over my wife. I was peeing all over myself. And she was sleeping next to me, and so she was just getting the effects produced by alcohol. She didn't think it was funny. I didn't think it was funny. What was funny is I went out and bought a brand new mattress the next day. Because, you know, I was never going to do that again. And the funny thing that I say is she went out the next day and spent $20 on a plastic mattress cover. She thought it was going to happen again, and she was right. And it started happening on a regular basis. I started losing control of my bladder. At that point in time, she had had enough. I had had enough of her. We had a little boy finally. It took 17 years for her to be able to carry a baby. He was born in 1994. We did not agree on much. We didn't get along on much. We went and saw the movie Forrest Gump, and it was the first time we ever agreed on a name. And so my son's name's Forrest. He's 17 years old, and since he was 5 years old, he's been to probably 1,500 AA meetings. Now, I go to almost all closed discussion meetings, and so my son is not allowed in the room because, like I said, I respect the traditions. He grew up at coffee bars. He grew up on couches in other rooms at other meetings. But he never sat in a meeting until a couple of years ago when we started a newcomer open meeting at Central. But he learned a lot about people at a coffee bar. He learned a lot about what his dad had. He knows that I was a sick man for a long time. I drank for over 37 years before I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I came there, it wasn't for me to get sober. It wasn't because I was an alcoholic. It was recommended I go there by my stepmother, who I knew she worked for Hillsborough County Courthouse. I didn't know what she did. And when I came to find out what she did for almost 30 years for Hillsborough County Court, was she was the lady who worked with all the judges who handled DUI cases. She interviewed you if you drove drunk, and she told you how many meetings to go to get your paper signed. And that's a pretty small world because I had no clue. And now when I chair a meeting, sometimes there's 30 people in the room got to get their paper signed. And it was wild. There are no coincidences in AA. They're just not. I thought there were for a long time. I came to the meeting. I cried at my first meeting. A friend of mine had committed suicide because he was tough loved out of his house. Don't come home if you're drunk again. He got drunk. He set his car on fire. My whole life was spinning around me. I went to his funeral, and I went to an AA meeting at Central at noon. I walked in there. I burst out in tears. I blubbered something about if you AAs don't, or you people don't stop drinking, you're going to kill yourself. Kind of glad somebody gets it. I mean, there's people in there with 30 years sobriety, and they're looking at me like, ooh, this one's going to be a tough one, you know? And none of y'all had a trench coat on, and none of y'all smelled like vomit, and none of y'all were living under the bridge, and it was like, I must have hit the only AA meeting that had regular people in it, because, you know, I thought, that's what I thought. I thought y'all lived under bridges. And since I didn't, I wasn't one. And what they said at that first meeting was, why don't you try not to drink today? Just today, don't drink, and come back tomorrow. And we'll get a guy to talk with you. And I went back the next day. I was not planning to. The Central Orlando is almost directly across the street from my real estate office building. And I walked in the second day, and I burst out in tears, and I said, I can't quit drinking. You know? And I became an alcoholic. I realized right then that I could not control my drinking. I was powerless over alcohol. My life was way unmanageable by me at that time, but I didn't know it. And I kept coming back, and for about 27 days, every day I'd walk in, I'd burst out in tears. I can't quit drinking. And I didn't want to drink. I did not want to drink. When I left that meeting, I was just absolute not going to drink that day. All afternoon I'd pray, please God, don't let me drink. On the way home, my car would pull in the ABC and my hand would open up and there would be a bottle in my hand. It was automatic. It was not something I controlled. But I did control it. It was me. A gentleman named Leo told me to drink a bottle of arsenic, and I'll never forget that old man. He said, I'm tired of you trying to die slowly. Why don't you just go ahead and kill yourself tonight? And it was on a Friday, and I had such a resentment against that old man. that for the first time in 37 years, I went home and I did not drink and I did not take a drug, and I started my sobriety on a resentment. The problem with starting your sobriety on a resentment is you don't stay sober. And I know that today. Because every 60 days, 90 days, I would decide that I was feeling better, things were working out at the house, I could go ahead and control this. I got this now. I've got it under control. You people who are just raised your hand back for 30 days, God bless you. I know a lot of people who can't make it back after the first 30 days, you know, and I did it a couple times, about 5 or 6. Each time I went out for a shorter period of time, and the consequences got worse. The pain got worse. You all screwed up my drinking just like you said you were going to. AA screws up your drinking, this little blind girl said. And I went, duh, you come to AA, you stop drinking, it screws up your drinking. That's not what you meant. She meant when you get a head full of AA and a belly full of booze, it's no longer fun. It's no longer fun. I knew that I was a real alcoholic. I knew that I was in that book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am. And I still am today. You know, I still work on my self-centeredness today. I did that for 3.5 years, and then I came to a speaker meeting. The guy up there was telling my story. Telling my story. Drank Schlitz malt liquor. Did the same thing I did. He didn't do near the bad stuff I did, but he did the same stuff I did. And after the meeting, a guy directed me over to him and introduced me, and I was kind of stuck because people kept asking me, do I have a sponsor? And I'd say, yeah, I got a sponsor. He didn't want me to tell you who he is, though. I sponsored myself for 3.5 years, and a sick man sponsoring a sick man. Nobody's getting well. Trust me. This guy's name was Joe, and I went up to him, and the guy who introduced us said, Joe, this is my friend Jim. He needs a sponsor. And Joe looked at me and he goes, are you done drinking? And I said, yeah. And so we took out our business cards, and on the back side of my business card, on the white side, I wrote down my phone number and I handed it to Joe, and I said, why don't you call me Monday if you want to sponsor me? Yeah. Well, since I didn't know much about sponsoring, he took out his business card on the white side, he wrote down his phone number, and said, why don't you call me Monday if you want me to sponsor you? And we turned over those two business cards, and we worked for the same real estate company in two different divisions. I had never met the man before. Now, if you don't believe in God, that was a God shot right there, and it opened my eyes. And I want to tell you, I never had a drink since that day. But the next day, after 9 months, I picked up a 9-month chip that night. I'd gone 9 months on my own without taking a drink, and I was proud. My ego was up. And I picked up a half gallon of whiskey the next day, because I could prove that I could drink one drink. And that night I opened that bottle and I poured one drink. And I don't know what happened. When I came to the next morning on my kitchen floor, I was covered in pee, vomit, and blood. And when I came to, I didn't know what I had done. I didn't know who I had hurt. I didn't know where I'd been. And I'd been there many times before, but this time, the horror was just overwhelming. I hurt myself. Just to let you know, I didn't hurt anybody else. I cracked my head on the way down, and I could have died from bleeding to death, but I didn't. I called Joe that morning, and Joe, one of the few times ever, Joe answered his phone. And I told him what I did, and he said, pour the rest of your booze out, go to your meeting at noon, pick up a white chip, and I'll meet you, and we'll start working the steps. And that was February 18, 2002, and I haven't seen necessary to take a drink since then. And I've been through some real tight situations. But picking up a drink has never crossed my mind. You know? It just doesn't cross my mind. I'm powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable. I know that. What kept me coming in and out was the second step. How could somebody as successful, as important in the community, as blah, 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 be crazy? And that's what the second step told me, is I was insane because God had to restore me to sanity. And like I said, I'm not a religious person. I wasn't raised in a religious atmosphere. But the word God didn't scare me when I saw it up on the steps. But that day I realized what everybody had been telling me is the insanity preceding the first drink. The insanity of being a real alcoholic and thinking it's going to be different this time. And I was thoroughly convinced that I was totally insane at that time, and I needed to do something about it. And I started working those steps, and I started working them with all my heart. There's a couple things that I like to remember to say. One is, when I took the third step, I absolutely took that third step. There have been times where I believe, decided to take my will back, and my life has gotten totally miserable. But God's my manager today. Higher power, whatever you want to call Him, I call Him God. My God is a personal God. But when it says in that prayer, take away my difficulties and victory over them, and may bear witness to those that I would help, thy love, thy power, and thy way of life, I realized that when I got sober, I was challenged by my young son to become an emergency medical technician. Now, I got a GED when I was on the chain gang. I carry it around with me. It's a certified copy of Orange County General Education Diploma. My math scores were 52. My English scores were 48. I don't know how I got a GED, but I got a GED. And I went and became an emergency medical technician. One of the most advanced medical courses that you can take. And became a nationally registered emergency medical technician. All because I started getting sober and I believed in God and I kept asking God to help me, because I can't spell them. I mean, some of them words are that long. There's no way I can do that stuff. I graduated with 2 B's and an A in a class that I shouldn't have even joined. But one of the most important things about that take away my difficulties is, one thing I never prayed about was my hepatitis. I never could give blood. I never could donate any plasma, even when my sister was dying. Because once you get hepatitis C, it doesn't go away. Once I graduated from the EMT course, they highly recommend you get the AB hepatitis vaccine, because if you're going to go into places, and I do things, haven't for a while, but I'm also a natural disaster responder trained by the National Guard. So the places like Katrina and things like that, where things get real nasty, is where I would go. And so I went to my doctor to get this done, and he said, there's no point in you get the AB vaccine because you've got the enzymes from hepatitis C. But we haven't done blood work for years, and we'll go ahead and do blood work. Now, I've got a red dot on my file at my doctor's office. I just want you to know. And that red dot is a signification that you don't give me anything to get me intoxicated. I don't take pain medication, things like that. It could set off my allergy again, and I don't want that. So he knows that I'm in AA, and when the blood results came back, he called me in instead of just saying over the phone, hey, come in and get the vaccine or something. He came in and sat me down and said, well, here's the deal. Your blood results are back, and you have no hepatitis enzymes in your body at all. And he used to be the medical examiner for Orange, Osceola, and Seminole County. And he said, I can't, as a medical professional, explain to you what happened. But you do not. He can explain. But you can't get there from where I was. And he said, as a medical professional, I can't tell you what happened, but all I know is you're going to that program called AA, and something's changed. And so, just keep going. And so that's one of my difficulties that was taken away, and I never asked God to take it away. He did it without my permission. God's taken a lot of things away from me without my permission. And all of them have been things that I needed taken away from me. The four step, you know, people get hung up and go out and drink all the time on the four step. It's what you did. It's who you were. It's not who you are now. If you've taken that third step, you're not the same person anymore. I wasn't. And so writing that stuff down wasn't a big deal. Sharing it with somebody else, it's not a big deal. I mean, there are some things that I really was ashamed of, but I was sick. And I realized today that that's what I was. I was sick. I wasn't doing it because I was a bad person. I was doing it because I was sick. I needed alcohol. My body craved alcohol. 6 and 7, 8 and 9, the action steps of this program. You know, if you don't do them, I've watched too many people go back out. I've watched young people. I love young people in AA. God, I wish I knew about AA when I was young. I wouldn't have come, but I wish I knew about it. But the bottom line is, you know, we have people come in all the time at Central, and they get sober and they get a couple of months, and I understand, you know, I'm not condemning them, I understand. But then they decide everything's okay and I'm going to go back out. And we bury them all the time. We bury young people all the time. Because it's not just alcohol anymore. They mix it with things, and, you know, very, very seldom do we bury somebody with alcohol poisoning anymore. It's an OD of something with alcohol. And they don't have to. They don't have to if they just surrender. You know, that first step is all about surrender. Today, the 12th step is all about carrying this message. Like I said, I'd love to take it into detox. I go to a meeting a day. I go to 3 meetings a day right now because I only live a few miles from my place. And I'm jobless for the first time that I can remember. I have no income. I filed for bankruptcy. I've just gone through about 11 months of the most heartbreak breakup of an emotional love affair. And it's supposed to be that way. God has it that way for a reason. And I've come out the other side, and I haven't had a drink. You know, I don't have to take a drink today, no matter what. When it talks about, in the beginning of the book, it talks about you can't have any reservations. I had lots of reservations, and I heard a guy say, if you got reservations, you're going someplace. And I know if I have reservations today, I'm going to go either to the morgue or going to prison. So I don't have any reservations because I don't want to drink. I don't want to hurt anybody. But it talks about the idea that somehow, someday, we can drink like other people has to be smashed. Now, they used words back in 1939 when they put this book together. They didn't say broken. They didn't say cracked. They didn't say chipped. They said smashed. And if you look at the word smashed, it means broke beyond all repair. You can't put it back together. And so my idea that I might drink again, like other people, had to be broke beyond all repair. And it was. It was broke beyond all repair that last time I took a drink. I knew that the next time I was going to die. The book talks about it. For me to drink is to die. I don't know about anybody else. I don't pronounce anybody an alcoholic. That's up to each person. But I know in the book when it talks about a real alcoholic, it's talking about me. It talks also about in the book, somewhere in the first 50 pages, during the second step, it talks about that every person has to eventually come to a conclusion, come to a choice. They give you a choice. They don't give you many choices in the book. They tell you what's going to happen. That they say either God is everything or God is nothing. God either is or He isn't. And the next line is, what's your choice to be? So each one of us has our own choice. If we're in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we really are powerless over alcohol and our life run by ourselves is unmanageable. Because I realize today that my life run by me today is still unmanageable. If I don't let God lead my life, if I don't put Him in the driver's seat, I'm going to screw things up. I've proved it over and over. You gave me hope when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know that that's what I was looking for. You gave me peace of mind, and that's what I stole from all those people when I was breaking in their houses thinking I was stealing their booze. I stole their peace of mind, and you all gave it back to me. You gave me the ability to love unconditionally, no matter who you are. You gave me a responsibility that when somebody reaches out their hand, anyone, anywhere. The responsibility statement doesn't say alcoholics. It says anyone, anywhere reaching out their hand. I want the hand of AA to be there to help. And for that, I'm responsible. You taught me about forgiveness. And forgiveness is the biggest thing I've learned. When we say the Lord's Prayer, a lot of meetings end with the Lord's Prayer. Most of the meetings that I've been to end with the Lord's Prayer. I learned that one of the most important words in the Lord's Prayer has two letters in it. And it's as. Forgive me my trespasses as I forgive those who trespass against me. So if I'm asking my God to forgive me for my sins, for my defects of character, for my trespasses, He's only going to forgive me as much as I'm willing to forgive somebody else. And so I have to have unconditional forgiveness for anybody in the rooms. and I do today, and it took me 10 years to learn. And it doesn't have to take, like I said, I'm a redneck, I'm kind of slow, it takes me a little while. But today I know to forgive somebody else is to get the forgiveness that I need from God, whether I know it or not. I heard a speaker say this recently, and I believe it with all my heart. I know what I do between the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer. But what am I showing you what I do between the Lord's Prayer and the Serenity Prayer? I know what I do for an hour during a meeting. But what am I showing the newcomer that I'm doing for the other 23 hours of my life? I hope I'm showing him what y'all taught me. Thanks for letting me be here.